Every Tuesday at a Buffalo Wild Wings near you, when you purchase a traditional snack or small wing, you get one free. Yep, you heard that right. A free traditional snack or small wing. We're making Tuesdays twice as good. Enjoy award-winning and authentic Buffalo, New York-style wings, hand-spun in your choice of one of our 21 signature sauce and seasonings. Valid at participating locations for a limited time for dine-in and takeout. Restrictions apply. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings. Beer. Sports.
Christopher Media, let's make some noise.
Genetics, what can it mean? The ability to perfect the physical and mental characteristics of every unborn child. Of genetic engineering.
To choose the genes. Society.
In the not too distant future, our DNA will determine everything about us. A minute drop of blood, saliva, or a single hair determines where you can work, who you should marry, what you're capable of achieving. In a society where success is determined by science, divided by the standards of perfection, one man's only chance...
How do you expect to pull this off?
I don't know exactly.
...is to hide his own identity.
This is the last day that you're going to be you and I'm going to be me.
...by borrowing someone else's.
Congratulations.
What about the interview?
That was it.
Do you think you'd be doing what you're doing if it wasn't for who you are, what you are?
I have a feeling he might be there under false pretenses, playing somebody else's hand.
They've got my picture plastered up all over the place. They'll recognize me.
They won't recognize me.
They'll recognize me.
I don't recognize you. They won't believe that one of their elite could have suckered them all this time.
They are going to find me.
But in a place where any cell from any part of your body can betray you, how do you hide? When we all shed 500 million cells a day. Ethan Hawke. Uma Thurman. Welcome to Gattaca.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Join me once again is Mr. Chris Cummins.
Hello, everybody.
Also back with us this week is Mr. Skiz Sizek.
Hi, everybody.
On this episode, we are discussing the 1997 film from director Andrew Niccol, Gattaca. Also written by Niccol, the film stars Ethan Hawke as Jerome Morrow. Or is he? He's actually Vincent Freeman, a naturally occurring person in a world where people can be genetically engineered for a price, of course. This creates a new elite class where genes determine privilege. Vincent impersonates Jerome through a rather elaborate scheme in order to fulfill his dream of leaving the planet and becoming an astronaut. Yada, yada, yada. Spoilers. Deal with it. Skiz, when was the first time you saw Gattaca, and what did you think?
I don't remember the first time I saw it, because I actually thought that it came out a lot earlier than it did, because I seem to remember watching it at work at a video store. But it came out in the fall of 97, which I guess was around, I guess I was still working in a video store then, but not much. But anyways, long story short, I thought I watched it at a different video store. So I guess I saw it in 97 or whenever it came out on video, and I loved it. I was sort of surprised that I didn't really know anything about it. Like there, it didn't seem like there was any buzz that I had heard. It wasn't really renting that well. Yeah, and I just couldn't understand why. I thought it was a very cool, original sci-fi film, especially for at the time. I remember the title for some reason. Every time I would hear the title, I would think of Al Pacino, you know, running around going, Gattaca, Gattaca.
They should have gotten Al Pacino to do the ad campaign. No, because I totally think that too.
Gattaca! Gattaca! Gattaca!
I think of John Travolta doing it in Saturday Night Fever.
Attica, 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 Attica.
Maybe it would have fared better at the box office if that was the case. I don't know.
They could have had a Gattaca off. It could have been like the Ant-Man trailer, but instead of Michael Douglas and Paul Rudd doing that whole slapping thing, it could have been Al Pacino and John Travolta doing it and just going... Chris, how about you? When did you see it and what did you think?
The first time I saw it was probably in, I guess, early 98, whenever it hit DVD. A friend of mine, this is back in the 90s, mind you, when mixtapes were a thing, a friend of mine put the theme song, Michael Nyman's amazing opening theme, on a mixtape, and I'm like, what the hell is this movie? And he's like, oh, it's this fantastic Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman science fiction movie. At the time, I had a real bug up my ass about Ethan Hawke. I hadn't seen any... I wasn't all that familiar with him other than Reality Bites. I was like, I'm not, you know, watching the movie with a guy who looks like clove cigarettes. I have no desire to see that. You know, I was kind of talked into watching it on DVD, and I was floored by it. It became one of these movies that I just kind of was obsessed about, and I made it kind of my own personal mission to spread the gospel of Gattaca, because I was really blown away by how smart of a movie it was, just kind of dealing with a lot of things that I felt were going to be an issue down the road with mankind. And given the way things are going scientifically right now, maybe not so much. Down the road, hopefully, science will reign again, and these kinds of problems may become an issue. I don't know why I had to get political there and get off on a tangent, but yeah, I love this movie from the start, Mike.
It's funny, I also had a real bug on my ass about Ethan Hawke, but luckily I had seen, despite my better judgment, I had seen Before Sunrise, which completely changed my opinion on him, because I was also very much of that Reality Bites. I mean, I hated Reality Bites so much that it colored my perceptions of everyone involved with it, everyone who liked the movie, everyone who talked about the movie, everyone who owned a Dr. Zaius doll, everybody, anything to do with that movie. Reality itself, I couldn't stand after that movie. Luckily, Before Sunrise turned me around, and I'll be frank, I don't remember when I first saw Gattaca, because again, it's got a bad title. I mean, it's a clever title in that it's just, you know, GATC being used for it. But yeah, I'm right there with you, Skiz. Every time I think of the title, I think of Al Pacino, which at this time, Scent of a Woman, that kind of turned me off from Pacino. Even Sim 1, which also was the same director, Andrew Niccol, and writer, yeah, that didn't do it for me either. But yeah, this was such a clever science fiction film, and it's a sci-fi film, but it's like one of those really low rent science fiction films. I mean, there's probably a lot more special effects in this movie than I give it credit for, but this really reminds me of those films that are in that mold of like Alphaville, where we'll take you to interesting locations, put you in interesting clothes, give you some good dialogue to expound, and that's about it. I mean, we get a couple shots of rocket ships taking off, but even those are almost superfluous to the story, because this really, at the heart of it, is a really solid tale.
They're trying to have this movement towards cerebral science fiction, and for better or worse, movies like this and, depending on your view on it, Strange Days and 12 Monkeys, like, they were trying to do more than just be, they were trying to be intelligent science fiction about, you know, the world we live in and where we could be going, and I really like that. You know, we had this brief period in the 90s where it was, hey, we're going to have these smart science fiction films again. Of those three I just mentioned, I think maybe 12 Monkeys was the only successful one financially. But yeah, I enjoy this movie because I do think it's this kind of really fun retro future movie that has a lot to say and is just packed with actors that I love in it as well.
Yeah, the cast is absolutely amazing. I mean, everybody on down the line. I mean, I love Elias Koteas. I love Blair Underwood. I mean, it's almost one of those where it's like, you know, the third guy to the left is somebody who you know and you really care about. And it is filled with so many great faces. It's filled with some unusual faces too. I mean, the use of Gore Vidal as an actor rather than as a writer or as a, like kind of a mouthpiece is really interesting. And I think that he does a pretty good job in this. I don't know if it's just me or not, but him being this kind of puffy white guy with white hair, he seems like he's on one side of a mirror and Ernest Borgnine's on the other side of a mirror. And again, Ernest Borgnine barely in this movie, but every time he's on screen, he makes me smile.
Yeah, same with Alan Arkin. Yeah, I'm always happy to see him in a film, and, you know, we don't see him that often. But I really wanted him to, triumph over Anton. As I was really rooting for him. I mean, before you find out, in spoiler, before you find out that, you know, his boss is, you know, the brother of the guy they're looking for, you know, I'm just rooting for Alan Arkin to put this young guy in his place. I'm kind of sad it never really happens, but still, he's great. Like, every second he's on screen, I'm loving him.
The relationship that he has with Anton is one of the most interesting things in the movie, because we as the audience don't know that Anton is Vincent's brother. And then even when we do, we don't necessarily know what his end game is. Like, is he going to support his own brother? Is he going to turn his brother in? Is he going to, you know, ruin this long con that Jerome/Vincent has been pulling, or what is going to happen? So the push and pull between Arkin and Anton is really, there are times where I think, like, oh, Anton is putting on the brakes of the investigation, and then other times it feels like he's really putting on the gas in the investigation. So I don't necessarily know at any one point, is he trying to further this or is he trying to slow it down?
Yeah, and I like that a lot, because I really think it does build up the suspense in the film, and just you know, it's quietly, like, unnerving, because you really are pulling for Vincent/Jerome to succeed and go to the stars, but I could very easily see this movie have, not as the happiest of endings, but have it be a complete downer of an ending instead of this kind of life-affirming thing that it winds up to be. So I wasn't sure that he was going to succeed. I think the movie could have very easily, like, put a sledgehammer across your face at the end and be like, yeah, in this type of world that we live in, those who dream who aren't the privileged have their dreams smashed. I feel like it could have gone that way very easily.
When it's nice the way that they set up this world, this whole world where you can order your children, and the way that the story is laid out is very nice. We get this introduction to the world a little bit, and then once we get the death of the director at the Gattaca facility, then we go into this extended flashback, and then we get Vincent narrating it. And I'm going to vacillate between Vincent and Jerome. For the most part, I think I'll call him Jerome, but sometimes I'll call him Vincent. That is the Ethan Hawke character. And we get his voiceover taking us into this world. Once this sequence is over, then we don't get his voiceover again, which is nice, because he kind of takes us by the hand, leads us back into his past, tells us more about him as a person. And then once we rejoin the present day, we don't get that again. So we don't have this really ponderous narration. Like, we could have gotten some really awkward lines, but as it was, you know, he's the person we're supposed to identify with. So it was really nice that he just says, okay, let me tell you about me, and let me tell you about the world in which we live, and just kind of takes us in here and introduces us nicely to how things are set up. And he is one of these, you know, his parents didn't have him genetically engineered. And as soon as he comes out of the womb, he's already got a doctor there saying, okay, he's got 44% chance of manic depression. He's got this percent chance of this, yada, yada, yada. And then he's got 99% chance of heart failure, and he won't live until he's, you know, past his 30s. And after that, his parents treat him like he's made out of glass, and his dad just can't deal at all. So they end up having another child who is genetically engineered, and that's where we get the Blair Underwood character talking to us about what they can do for these children. And at the same time, while we're seeing this brother grow up, Anton, who takes his father's name, as we're seeing Anton growing up, we're also seeing Vincent being shut out of things. And it's subtle. You know, it's not like, some of it is maybe a little heavy-handed, but really, they're showing us pretty much institutional racism, and now it is genoism, as far as, oh yeah, we can't even handle the insurance if your kid were to come to our school, you better just leave them at home.
I really think that this, you know, this genoism could very well be a problem in the future. You know, if Again, I don't know if this specific future that we're on course for right now, but I do feel like that this genuism thing, you know, I have to say I'm such a sucker for any kind of stories where genetic engineering is at the heart of it. Just then, I think that goes back to my Star Trek II thing that I have, but I really think that that this movie does kind of raise some really interesting questions about how we treat each other, because as a society, we're so used to being prejudiced on basis of one thing, and now, you know, here's a future where it's supposed to be a better future, and boom, this hatred and prejudice is coming to us on an entirely new stage. And I think that's an interesting thing to explore, and this movie does it excellently.
Some of the little things that popped up in the film, I can see those becoming a reality in the not too distant future, which is when this film is supposed to take place. It was like a window where the women were going and having hair checked and their mouths swabbed after kissing guys to find out whether these are guys that would make good partners. Like, I can see stuff like that coming sooner or later. We may already have it, for all I know. But, yeah, there's just a lot of things in this film that I hate to say are predicting the future more than just being fantasy about the future.
Chris, you mentioned Star Trek II, and there's the whole idea of Khan being the, you know, the guy who wins the genetic wars, and how he has been engineered to be this perfect being. And looking at Ricardo Montalban, I have no doubts in my mind whatsoever. There's a great article that I read about Gattaca, and they really did a lot of comparisons between Gattaca and Star Trek, and that whole idea of Star Trek being this inclusive universe. Like, once we get, you know, the 50s, we had Nichelle Nichols on the deck. There weren't a whole lot of other people of color around other than, you know, Sulu. But we started to get more of that as we went along. You know, Next Generation, we had Geordi, we had Michael Dorn. So now we're including Klingons, we're including androids, but they're still like, you know, Star Trek's so white, right? You know, it just, we still have the majority of our characters are white people. And with this, it's interesting because we've got Blair Underwood, who's there talking about genetics. We don't get a whole lot of other speaking people of color roles. Like, we get the woman who runs the underground club where Jerome and Eugene go. But otherwise, we don't necessarily have them as main characters, though we get their faces. And we get the faces, especially at the very, very end, the other astronauts who are in the ship with Jerome are, you know, there's a Asian woman, there's an Asian man, there's a black man. So we see these faces there with him.
I was trying to think of how many women actually have speaking roles. I think it's just Cavendish and Uma Thurman and the mother, right? Are there any others?
Well, there's the Asian doctor who takes the readings at the beginning. Yeah, there's that woman at the club. There's like the woman who comes in and says that she kissed her boyfriend deeply so they can take a good swab. But yeah, there's not a whole lot. Apparently, and I missed it. I was even looking this time. Apparently, Maya Rudolph plays the nurse, who the delivery nurse. I totally miss that every single time I've watched this.
I've never caught that. I always see Ken Marino as, I believe, the Ken Marino from the state, as the guy who I think actually that woman who kissed the guy you were just talking about is going. He's going to like run a test on, you know, to see if they're a match or whatever. But he's in it for like a second, and as a huge fan of the state, that which was on around the same time this movie came out, that really kind of takes me out of the movie for a second. This whole idea of eugenics and kind of doing things to enhance and make your humanity better, and invariably it winds up with people losing their humanity, it's kind of a tried and true sci-fi trope. And I think this movie really is the first one to just delve into this in such like a serious manner. Because it's a very intellectual kind of science fiction film, which is part of the reason why I think it bombed at the box office. But I know, I do know that, like, this, I'm involved with, like, Nerd Night Philadelphia here in Philly, and I know that this movie has been, like, the focus of talks from geneticists who love or hate this movie for reasons of either it supports what they want to do or it negates what they're trying to do in their own work. So it's interesting that this movie's had kind of like a second life within the scientific community.
Who's it? Greg Sestero from The Room is apparently an uncredited extra in this film. I just saw that on IMDb, but I seem to remember reading that. Maybe that was mentioned in the Disaster Artist book or something. That was some of the work that he got when he moved to LA.
Another genetically superior person. That beard, at least. I could never grow a beard that looks that good.
Anyway, how is your sex life?
The way that we look at and follow and change our opinion of the Uma Thurman character, Irene, because at first she seems like she's being set up as being a very duplicitous woman, and then when she goes and takes that hair of Jerome's, or she thinks it's Jerome's hair, and gets it tested and finds out what a perfect person he is. He's what, like a 9.4 out of a 10, right? She gives us a really blank expression, and we don't necessarily know how to read that. And then as the movie goes on, we start to read that as being disappointed because she is not a perfect person. She's got this heart condition. I'm very surprised that she actually managed to get into Gattaca, because it seems like you shouldn't even be able to get in the door if that's the case. I mean, that whole idea of him coming in, taking a urine test, and Xander Berkeley just saying, okay, you got the job, and that's it. You know, there is no resume that you're looking at. Your resume is your DNA. And that, I mean, talk about old boys network, right? It's just like, yeah, we know this guy. He's fine. He's from a good family or whatever. So come on in and you've got the job.
I know there's a lot more information about this movie in its original shooting script. And I always felt like the Irene character, like a lot of her was left on the cutting room floor, to the point where like I found myself wondering if like at any point they had the intention of doing a subplot where she herself was kind of like faking her perfection. But obviously that would like unwrite the fact, that would kind of undo the fact that she is, you know, she has been genetically enhanced, but still has this problem, making her kind of the inverse of Jerome. It's just like, that was a character who I was intrigued with in this movie the first couple of times I saw, because Thurman is great in this film, but her character is really underwritten, which kind of bums me out. I would like to see more of her in this.
Yeah, it seems like we can either have more Eugene or more Irene, and we can't necessarily have both. That's the way it feels like it's being set up. And even Anton ends up getting short shrift. There's a scene of him in the screenplay where he actually goes and visits a god baby, like, or whatever the term, an invalid rather than invalid, an invalid person, someone who wasn't created genetically perfect. He goes to see an invalid prostitute and is just like, oh, you're so gorgeous and it's amazing that you weren't genetically modified, but who knows how long you're going to live and yada yada. And it's this weird thing of like him. It's like, it kind of reminds me of the cop in The Mac. We just talked about The Mac, where it's like Don Gordon going to see the black prostitute and he's just talking away and talking about how this woman, you know, represents so much more to him because she's black, basically. And with this, it's like he's slumming it with this invalid prostitute. And when she gets a little mouthy with him, then he ends up putting her down, not literally, but he ends up, you know, insulting her. So it's just like, okay, this is a strange scene, but that's really the only time we get to see Anton other than when he's investigating his brother.
I want to go back to the doctor. As we were saying, like and I think it's maybe even said in the film that the urine test pretty much is the job interview. But then as we find out later in the film, the doctor's been on to him the entire time. So I'm wondering if the urine test is the job interview for everybody, and that might be how Uma Thurman's character, you know, maybe there was more to it for her, and she, I don't know, didn't have this simple way to get in and managed to prove herself otherwise. But yeah, I don't know. I'd still try to piece it together. I guess the doctor's son is a big fan of Jerome the swimmer, and that's how he knows that Jerome the invalid is not the real Jerome. And if I read all that correctly.
I never took it that way. I thought that he was a fan of Jerome the astronaut, not necessarily the Jude Law version of Jerome. So that's interesting. I never would have thought about that before.
Yeah, that really just kind of opens a few things up now that I think about it. Like, with him being a fan, he would have realize that, you know, Jerome paralyzed himself or was paralyzed and therefore could not be possibly going to space. Yeah, Skiz, that's an amazing interpretation of that.
Yikes, I thought that's...
Never occurred to me. And I'll tell you, I would love to know which way was the filmmaker's intent, because I think I kind of like your interpretation better of the one I've had these past 20 years.
Yeah, I always thought that Xander Berkeley, Dr. Lamar, I always thought that his kid was also an invalid and that he respected Jerome, the Ethan Hawke character, as far as being able to con his way into the system and be able to succeed and be able to go into space. And, you know, he is a hero to the invalids who know about him, which are very few and far between. You know, this is a very closed conspiracy. It's pretty much just maybe three or four people that really know about this. I mean, there's Borgnine, there's Jude Law, there's Tony Shalhoub, again, another like kind of throwaway character who is a wonderful face and a wonderful actor. And then there's Xander Berkeley. So, and eventually there is Uma Thurman and then kind of Anton. But Anton, when it finally comes, push comes to shove, he wants to take, Vincent home and basically make him be the invalid that he's meant to be. He shouldn't be pretending to be something more than he is.
I'm sorry. I'm still floored thinking about Skiz's interpretation and how much I love it. I gotta say that's right.
Yeah, because I never think about Jude Law. I never think about Eugene before the accident. And we know he's got a past. We know he won a silver medal. And I think the reason why he tried to commit suicide was because he got a silver and not a gold. And that whole line about, like, I should never be on the second tier. I should always be on the first tier. So you get that idea of privilege that comes with that, those perfect genes. And he's really one of the few characters who's so open about how perfect his genes are and the way that he'll talk to, like, service people when they send him the wrong hair color and he's talking to the service person on the phone. He's just like, I'm bored. And it's just like, wow, like such a privileged piece of shit.
Yeah. And then obviously he sees that Vincent, someone who is inferior, quotes, to him in every way, is able to, Although the real Jerome is helping him do that, he's able to do so much more with you know, being a, quote, lesser person that, yeah, no wonder he burns himself up at the end. Spoiler. But, yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like at this point I want to take, like, a five-minute break and just ponder what Skiz said because, I've done this show a bunch of times, but I've never had the experience I'm having right now, and I love it, where, like, someone says something and I'm completely reevaluating how I feel about the movie because of it. And I absolutely love this. This is a first for me on the show. And Skiz, I gotta thank you for that, because yeah, wow, I'm loving this. Okay.
Glad I could help.
That's fantastic.
I do love when we start off that we see the rituals that he has to go through, just that work a day, you know, the scrubbing of the body, getting rid of everything. I kind of wish that I could exfoliate the way that Ethan Hawke does in this. I mean, I would be rubbish at the Gattaca world, just FYI, because I am one of the hairiest motherfuckers around. So I'd be shedding like crazy around here. The whole idea of one eyelash is able to trip him up almost. I mean, I would be dead in a second because I've got hair everywhere.
Yeah, I'm gonna second you on that, Mike, because I can't even wear like black t-shirts because my beard is just constantly, for listeners at home, I have a big red beard and it is just constantly unkempt and shedding. And I'm a freelance writer. I work from home, so it's kind of like I'll fully admit the glamorous life of a freelancer is you roll out of bed and onto your couch. And yeah, I do not have the wherewithal to deal with that regimen, because I just couldn't physically or mentally handle that. It would be so exhausting. So well done to him for putting up with that every day, because I know I couldn't.
Yeah, years ago, I gave up going to work without cat hair all over me.
Get those rollers going. Oh, my God.
I gave up on that. So, you know,
how genetically perfect is your cat?
I think they're pretty perfect.
Okay, well, there you go.
But I'm sure, you know, if I were in Gattaca, I would be leaving cat hair everywhere.
I have a pub, so the same deal here.
All the employees are accounted for, plus 35 cats and 22 dogs. I don't understand what's going on. Do you have a daycare here that I'm not seeing? There's a nice thing in the script where they refer to the FBI guys, the investigators, as J. Edgars, and then other people will call them Hoovers, as in J. Edgar Hoover, but then also as in Hoover Vacuum, because they're constantly vacuuming up all of the detritus that humans leave behind. And just that whole thing, just like Jerome leaving the hairs from, you know, the comb there, leaving skin cells from Jude Law everywhere. I mean, it's a really nice thing that he's doing. I'm sure that people have taken this movie apart and been like, well, what about this? What about that? But I like that they world build this and they set that tone right off the bat. And so really they kind of tell us a lot of things immediately. It doesn't leave us constantly questioning, and it doesn't leave us with some huge thing, this big red flag where it's just like, well, gosh, what about this thing? You know, like they're even talking at the beginning, like if you come in for job interviews, yeah, they can get your DNA off of the door handle, off of the envelope that you sent your resume in, off of this, off of that, or there's always the drug test. So it's just nice that they take care of a lot of those questions immediately, and they let me relax my brain and just enjoy this film rather than, you know, constantly picking it apart with logic questions. It lets me actually take apart the bigger ideas rather than worrying about the minutiae.
Yeah, that's definitely some of the brilliance of Andrew Niccol there, is how he preemptively sees that the audience is going to want to lose themselves in that kind of, those kind of questions. And I just, you know, Niccol's this guy who I think had a really promising career, who never really delivered on things. Like, I'm not a big Truman Show guy, but I really feel like this movie was him at his best, and I wish he wound up having a more interesting career than what he's had to date.
I am also not a Truman Show fan. Recently, as in like a few hours ago, watched Lord of War for the first time, which I think should have started off with All My Life, I Always Wanted to Be an Arms Dealer. There's like a real Goodfellas vibe to that movie for me. But I will say that I have enjoyed some of his other films. I really enjoyed In Time, which I know gets a lot of shit, especially because it's got some of the worst CGI. There's one shot in there that always makes like the top 10 worst CGI in movies bit. I mean, it's up there with like Sharknado kind of stuff. It's this really bad car crash that I can't believe that they left in that movie. And I don't mean car crash like, oh wow, that was a car crash. No, it's a car crash in the movie. And it looks awful. But for the most part, I enjoy what he's done, some more than others. I just watched Anon on Netflix the other day, and I'm kind of glad that we did this episode because it's prompted me to watch some of his other movies that I haven't seen before. And I liked Anon. I think that it had interesting ideas. I think they could have done a little bit more with it, but I had heard some really negative things about the film, and I actually ended up enjoying it quite a bit. And it's another one of those we're in the future because we all wear fedoras kind of thing. But I do like the idea of walking down these streets that are completely plain, completely gray, and that all of the advertisements are now inside of people's eyes. They're not necessarily out and about. So it's kind of a nice thing. It's like taking that Minority Report advertising even farther.
I don't think I've seen any of his other films. I never saw Truman Show, but yeah, I know it's a shame for him to create something like Gattaca and then not have the kind of career that should have come out of it. But at the same time, man, he created something like Gattaca. I mean, if that had been his only film, even if it flopped, if that had been his only film, that's a pretty good film to have as your legacy.
Another thing this movie does that I really love when science fiction films, you know, they're not just based in a heightened reality, but they're based in what looks to be like a physical reality. And by that, I mean, I love the looks of the architecture in this film. I just, the visual style of this film is great because it is so grounded in this kind of retro futurism. You know, you got like, I think one of the buildings was a Frank Lloyd Wright building that they used. And just, you know, having it set, there are two ways to do this kind of thing. You can do the cheesy yet wonderful way that Logan's Run did when you filmed inside of a Dallas shopping mall, or when Battle for the Planet of the Apes shooting just in Century City, and that always looks like it's just people in costumes set against contemporary settings. Whereas this movie, I think it really does have this kind of future timelessness to it, and I love that kind of, I love the look of this film. I love, like, I mean, if the society wasn't such a shit show, this would be a future I would want to live in. You know, but yeah, I mean, just visually and the aesthetics of this film, I'm absolutely in love with. And I feel like that's something that doesn't get enough credit when this movie is discussed, too, is just how beautiful it looks.
Yeah, it's definitely beautiful. I was just thinking of something that I wonder if you guys have an idea on. And that is when he's in the car and they pull him over, he takes out the contacts and he throws them away. Why didn't he just put them in a pocket or something? Like, knowing that he's not going to be able to see after that moment. I mean, I know without that problem, it doesn't set up the rest of the scene, but that's like one thing. As I was watching the film, I'm thinking, why did he throw those away? He should have just, you know, put them on his knee or something.
Especially given that society, like, someone could have very easily, if someone was tracking him, gone and found DNA of his on the contact lens, and that opens a whole bunch of potential plot holes there. Yeah, that's a good point.
Damn it, Skiz, I just talked about how this movie makes you think about the bigger questions. Yeah, he is the master of sleight of hand. All of those quick palms that he does where he's putting the heart monitor on, where he's swapping out the blood, where he's obviously the urine all the time. I mean, there's so many different things that he does where it was just like palming stuff. I mean, he must have watched that whole series of Close Magic that Paul Rudd watched in the Ant-Man sequel. The thing that I really like about this, and that wasn't in the original script, was the line from Eugene when Jerome is becoming Jerome, when Vincent is becoming Jerome, and all of the things that he's doing. You know, he has to get his teeth fixed. And I never noticed how bad Ethan Hawke's teeth were until he says the line of, you have somebody in mind, and you just see these really jagged looking teeth. He gets his teeth fixed, he gets his hair changed, he gets his eyes fixed, or he gets contacts, yada, yada, yada. But he is not nearly as tall as Jude Law was. So when he does that, when he gets that operation to become taller, and Eugene says to him, I'll never doubt you now. You know, that line, that moment is not in the original script, but that is one of those great things where you realize, like, now Jude Law realizes just how committed he is to this, to go through all of that pain, all that discomfort for so long. That's one of the great moments in this film.
Yeah, and it definitely shows where his respect for, you know, what Vincent is doing, it really becomes real at that moment. You know, I think before he was just kind of, you know, taking the money and not really thinking about it. But at that point, I think it's a real realization of how dedicated he is and how determined he is that to accomplish this goal and not let anyone stand in his way.
We have to talk about the theme of swimming that goes through this movie, because there's so much swimming in here. We've got the major thing of Vincent swimming against Anton at the beginning when they're young, and that happens right after they slice their fingers and they're supposed to become blood brothers, but if memory serves, they don't actually commingle their blood. But I think blood and swimming, there's a line at one point about when you're weightless, it's the closest thing to being in the womb. And obviously you're swimming around kind of in the womb. And there's this whole idea of the real Jerome, that Eugene was a swimmer, the silver medalist swimmer. And even in the script, a lot of the scenes of dialogue that happen actually happen in Jerome's house, where he's got one of those, what do they call them, an infinity pool, the pool that you could swim against all the time. So there's this whole idea of swimming going on, and I think it really does have stuff to do with the womb and with blood, because there's also, I think, another line about you can't change what's inside of you. You can't change what's swimming inside of you, perhaps, is the line. But, I mean, that seems like a nice theme that's going throughout this whole thing, and that the idea of defeating our antagonist, defeating Anton at the end, takes place with basically it's a swimming contest. It's like, oh, okay, that's kind of nice, because we never see him again. I mean, that's the end of his timeline in this movie. And it's a really nice way to show again that dedication from Vincent / Jerome, that he is the one that can best his brother, because he never thinks about the return journey, which is also what he's doing when it comes to space. He doesn't think about the return journey. He just thinks about getting there.
I always kind of, I mean, this is a little face value on my part, but I always kind of took it as kind of a sperm analogy, because he was, you know, Vincent was the sperm that made it naturally to, you know, fertilize the egg in a time where most people weren't having children in that way. You know, so he, yeah, it's a little corny and a little, as I said, like on the nose, but that's the way I always interpreted kind of all the swimming in this film, is just to kind of subtly remind you that he's one who made it naturally. He came from the victorious sperm out of thousands of other sperms to impregnate his mother. And, yeah, that was kind of the way I always took the swimming analogy, and I thought that was a nice touch, you know, to have that in a movie where most of the characters are just created in a lab and, you know, chosen that way, as opposed to, you know, the natural course of nature versus science, or not.
No, I can totally see that. I mean, the one thing in this movie that's a little on the nose for me is that his last name is Freeman, and it's just like, oh, okay. Luckily, I don't know if they even really say that more than once, maybe. So it's just like, okay, good. We're going to brush that one under the rug and not have to worry about that. And, you know, they could have gotten really into, like, the names of these characters, you know, Ernest Borgnine being Caesar and, you know, the detective being Hugo, and so you're thinking about Victor Hugo and all this kind of stuff, and it's like, no, good. We're not going to go necessarily down that path too much. It's there if you want to look into it. I mean, even the idea of Tony Shalhoub's character's name is German, and there's a line, like, I don't even think they name his character in the movie, but there's a line in the script where he introduces himself and he says, I'm German, and the Vincent character is waiting for more, and he's just like, no, that's my name. You know, just like, so it's like, okay. But yeah, it's nice that we're not, cause I'm trying to remember what, Gore Vidal's name is, cause he's got another one where it's just like, okay, yeah, that's.
It's Joseph, J-O-S-E-F.
Oh, you're right. Director Joseph, as in like Joseph K from the, from the Kafka novels. And Irene Cassini, being named after the Cassini telescope. And I think that Cassini must have been a scientist. So I'm a bad person for not knowing, the whole Cassini-Huygens, thing going on there. So the mission that they ran. So my bad.
This is a movie podcast, not an astronomy podcast. So
yeah, but sometimes I go down weird roads. You know that. Luckily, you know, the parents aren't, like, it's Marie, but it's not Joseph as far as the father's name, so I'm glad that there isn't, like, a Christ metaphor happening in here. So we've avoided a lot of potential pitfalls with this.
Well, I'm sure all of that, you know, all of those aspects you just mentioned had this, you know, in 2008 or 2009, there was talk of turning this show into this movie into, like, a police procedural. For maybe Sci-Fi Channel, which would have been a nightmare had they done that. And I'm sure, you know, had that show gone anywhere, it would have just examined all of those themes and beaten them over the head and detracted from the magnificence that is this movie.
I was trying to think of the name of the 12-fingered pianist, but I don't know if they give his name.
That sounds dirty.
Yeah, it does. I know that there's a poster, but I don't remember if he actually had a name.
I like the way that he puts his hand over that hand. Talking about the privilege that Eugene shows, the other thing that is kind of a throwaway moment, but is really nice because we get to see Dean Norris show up for like a hot second, is when he starts berating Dean Norris, the cop character that he plays, about like, what's your badge number? What's your badge? And just like really laying into him. And again, just showing that like what a brat he can be when he turns it on.
This is the thing where the cop calls, says he's a cripple, and he's like, I'm not a cripple. I got hurt in training or something. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great scene because it shows that, you know, he knows how to be this asshole pretty much. And then, you know, for once he's actually using it for good.
Yeah. And when he has to make that crawl up those steps, and of course it's nice that the steps are this, you know, half of a double helix, right? When he goes crawling up those spiral stairs up to there, and that whole scene, and that's the first time that Irene is seeing the real Jerome. That's a really nice moment. And just the way that she picks up on that and carries it through. And, that's also like that really stressful moment because there's so many things that can go wrong in that. Just that we have, you know, there's allegedly in the script, at one point, Anton looks over and he sees a trail of sweat because Jerome slash Eugene has sweated so much when he was crawling up those steps, and he was going to follow that down. So you see him coming down the steps at one point, and I think that that was probably even shot, but I think that they cut around that so that just when he gets to that landing, he gets the phone call that they found the real person, that they found that it was actually, and it's nice that we are shooting around to who the criminal really is. And then once we find out that it's Director Joseph, and that his whole motivation is just that he wants to see this launch. He wants to see the launch almost as much as Vincent wants to see the launch. Vincent's going to be part of it, but Joseph really wants to see it because this is going to be the last time to be able to experience this before he ends up as an old man and dies.
Yeah, I was actually kind of wondering too, whether he really is the guilty one or if he just confesses so that they'll back off and the mission can go on as planned because he cares that much about the mission. But again, I could be reading too much into it because it seems like why wouldn't they have found him earlier if he really was the one who did it?
Well, if memory serves, they found his spit in the director's eye, which is kind of the smoking gun. But I want to say, in the script, at least, and I don't know if it made it into the movie, Alan Arkin, his character, does some actual old-fashioned police work and finds a fingerprint and manages to track him through a fingerprint, which is a really nice thing that we're kind of going back to a tried-and-true method. Like, that's the method that we use now, and now, you know, we're getting into more DNA evidence, and we have since the OJ trial, but, you know, this is, in the future, like, going back to fingerprints is so rudimentary, but this is an old cop with experience, and he actually remembers the old ways.
And solves the case. You know, so as I was saying earlier, in a way, I mean, they don't have that fingerprint in the film that I remember, but that would have been him showing up, this new guy, you know, this young boss of his that I was hoping for.
Yeah, I think if they had made that antagonism between Anton and Hugo a little bit more palatable, because I want to say that in the script, it's really Hugo who wants to go after this perp. You know, he just like, there's a murderer here. I'm going to solve this case. And he's just a dog with a bone. And it's Anton who is pushing back against him and being like, no, we, you know, let's go this way rather than, and he's kind of more sheltering, Vincent from the investigation. This way, we kind of have it both ways. We kind of have it where there's a real vacillation between the two characters. It's almost like they took their dialogue, split it back up in a different way, and just said, let's do it this way. Now, we'll never know. It's kind of one of those things where you have an actor read something several different ways, and then you just piece together the ones that you want and the ones that you say, well, this will be the most interesting. That's what it feels like. It almost feels like they said, let's play each of these scenes two ways, one where you're going after them and one where you're protecting them. Now where you're going after and now you're protecting them, and now we're going to switch it up in the editing, and we'll keep everyone on their toes at all times. But, you know, that could be me. That could be me making a movie, which I will never do.
I feel like the one thing we're really, you know, learning about in this movie, this is a movie that 21 years after the fact is still so much fun to speculate about. That is absolutely my biggest takeaway from this podcast so far, is how much fun this movie is to still discuss, because there's so much just embedded into it.
Well, I think it's really timeless too, because of the way that it was shot. I mean, we talked earlier about the use of like the fedoras for the cops, and the idea of, you know, these cars, these old cars, but then they put an electric hum under them. So now they're not gas cars anymore. They're electric cars. So it's this weird retro future thing that they're doing. So it really is kind of a timeless thing. Like if you go back now and you watch Alphaville, there's a lot of things that are still really super effective. I mean, the idea of like, you know, the tape machine and these kind of things, like now that's a little bit outmoded. But with this, I think they do really well to stay away from the tech, you know, and the displays on the screens are a little rudimentary, but that's actually okay. And I think they would have been rudimentary in 97. I think that they might have been like toning that down a little bit to almost make this more timeless. Like now we're not doing a Minority Report, you know, 3D model of stuff. We're not Tony Stark flipping things around and moving them around with our hands. We're still using keyboards, and we're even using keyboards as a lethal weapon.
I was surprised at how much static there is on the little TV screens every time you see their faces. Like it seems like even in 97 when the film was made, there wouldn't have been that much static on a TV screen that small.
Yeah, and those really low-res images that come up of them when it's, you know, and especially when Anton is flipping between the invalid Vincent and the valid Jerome, just going back and forth between those, and those pictures are just so low-res that you really can't tell. But, again, they kind of explain that away a little bit with Eugene saying, nobody looks at a picture. You know, you could put your picture on your name tag. Nobody looks at it. They just look at the genes. They don't care about any of that stuff. All right, we're going to take a break and play an interview with Dr. Lamar himself, Mr. Xander Berkeley, and we'll be back with that right after these brief messages.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. Yeah. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. Oh, that was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
From page to screen.
So they have, 9 times out of 10, they have to send it back to you unopened or just throw it in the garbage can.
Things don't always look exactly as we envision our life to look. But sometimes it works out and turns out even better.
Gregor Fisher, his bacon number is 2 because he was appeared with January Jones in Love Actually, and January Jones and Kevin Bacon appeared in X-Men First Class together.
I've got to say, the very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas. Now that just makes me want to rush out.
It's about the acting and about the writing. That's really what theater is for me.
Probably had more names than Prince or whatever. Never mind, there's a joke for the oldies. Who's Prince? Who's he? I'd just like to see Mr. Freeze hiring his bad guys going, right, okay, so you're a psycho, right, can you ice skate? Head over to iTunes, Spreaker, and Stitcher and put in the search box From Page to Screen.
I know you know who I'm talking about. It's that guy.
Yeah, yeah, with the eyebrows,
he's,
right?
He's in a million
the bushy
movies.
Eyebrows.
Sometimes they're bushy, but he also sometimes has a mustache.
Yeah, well, but he shaved. Well,
No, he didn't. You know who I'm talking about. You've seen him in a million movies. We just saw him in that one thing.
Yeah, he looks like a pug.
Listen to me, Chris Gore, and Anthony Ray Bench on the Film Threat Podcast.
You got questions. Sometimes we have the answers.
I'm Chris Cooling from Forgotten TV, and you're listening to The Projection Booth, the ultimate movie podcast.
I'm always curious as far as, because acting is one of the, I mean, it's one of the most thankless jobs when you're first starting out. I mean, it's always so difficult to actually get into it. I'm curious how you decided that this is going to be your calling and what brought you to acting.
Somewhere in my bio that my father was an artist and who became an art director and then head of the art department for a publishing company. My mother was a school teacher who had always been able to sew, and we didn't have a lot of dough, and so she sewed things that my big thrill was costumes over toys from very early on. And she could whip up a little costume for me, and I could happily go out into the woods and entertain myself as if I were someone else. That just was my enchantment from very early on, sort of a sense of both time travel and transformation that wasn't related particularly to performing for an audience in any way early on. And then later, I think in third grade, she helped put together a costume for me. I played Thomas Jefferson in some sort of pageant-like play about the Founding Fathers that was put on in third grade. And I just still remember, you know, she added ruffles to a white shirt and changed the buttons on a blazer and, you know, did various things and had boots. And I suddenly felt like I was Thomas Jefferson when I walked out there. And I can remember that feeling of just the costume had a power of magic for me. And then my father's involvement with art, always giving us art supplies every birthday and Christmas, and then his seeing the joy I got from the costumes led him to, by high school, I was taking the theater more seriously, and I was working with a community theater that had sort of really wonderful experimental theater company that had taken me under its wing. And he got me a great makeup kit and Richard Corson's book on stage makeup, and that became my Bible. And transformation in both summer stock and repertory theater early on became, and in college when I went off to college, and I went to college at Amherst, in Amherst at Hampshire College, which was the progressive brainchild of Smith and Mount Holyoke and UMass and Amherst. And you were able to do plays in any one of the schools when you went to any one of the schools. And so I did plays at all those schools pretty much. And it was my second year at college that my father saw me in a production of Twelfth Night. My parents came with my sister, who was going to Bennington at the time, and they went to visit her and then brought her and came and saw me playing Malvolio in Twelfth Night. And we went out afterwards, and it was my father's taking what I did very seriously that really sort of made me feel like this was going to be it, because I had tried not to take any acting classes at college at first semester, and just trying to resist the temptation to get a good liberal arts education, because everything in me had been oriented towards academia and advanced degrees sort of in the world I grew up in. And so I was trying to take my education very seriously. But it was the school that I went to was progressive. Progressive education was popular at the time. So it allowed me to indulge. And when somebody the second day at school asked me if I was an actor, and I told me I should come and audition for this play that was being cast. And I started doing plays one after the other. And they came up and saw me in Twelfth Night. And my father said afterwards that watching my performance and seeing what he did, that he couldn't imagine what else someone would need in order to make a go at this. He said, so if you want to stay here and get a degree, or if you want to come to New York and study there, if you want to go to London, I back you 100%. And that was the degree that I needed. In a way, that was the affirmation I needed more than any degree in terms of societal validation that had been pre-programmed in my mind. And I left school at that point and came to New York and studied there. And I'd already had a fair amount of classical training and experimental theater training, improvisation, and all the rest of it before coming to New York, and then but tried to, you know, study pretty seriously for a couple of years before just going out into the business. But I started getting plays right away after that, and I got an agent that whisked me out to California, and I started getting work pretty soon thereafter, and I just kept at it. Kept beating the odds on the one-armed bandit in the corner against all odds.
You weren't only, what, 25 years old when you started doing things like your role in Mommy Dearest and in MASH and Fire on the Mountain. I mean, you were pretty, you were just a squirt at that time.
Yeah, and I had been on stage for 10 years before that nonstop. Like I'd done, I can't remember how many, but there was, I don't think a month went by that I wasn't on stage from the time I was 15 until then.
Can you tell me a little bit about that that earliest role, the Christopher Crawford in Mommy Dearest?
It's funny. My second movie was Volunteers and Tom Hanks. I played his roommate in college. We hung out a lot in Mexico when we were doing that. And he used to tell this story as a cautionary tale to young actors about the brutality of Hollywood. I didn't find that out until years later. Yeah, I'd auditioned. It was a casting director that agent who brought me out had first introduced me to. Lynn Stallmaster was a very big, important casting director at the time, and it was over Paramount Studios, and Frank Perry was an important director at the time, and had done Diary of a Mad Housewife and other films, and his wife was his writing partner and collaborator, and I'd known about them, so it was a very exciting appointment to have to go over there, and the agent had stopped being an agent, and it was sort of a coincidence. I'd left the William Morris office that he brought me out to. It was too big for me at the time, and I'd sort of drifted a little bit to another smaller agency, but he'd had a really hard time tracking me down. And we had just run into each other that day by complete coincidence. And he goes, oh my God, you changed your phone number. I couldn't track you down, but he'd become a casting director himself. And Lynn Stallmaster had called him and saying, where is Xander Berkeley? You introduced me to this kid, Xander Berkeley. And he'd spent all day trying to get hold of me. And then we just run into each other in Beverly Hills because I was shopping for something, for Christmas for my parents. And he says, and he writes it down, he scribbles down the address, and I race over to Paramount, and they're where they're waiting for me, because he calls up, you know, and tells me, so, you know, one way or another, I just remember going, getting a suit, borrowing it on my way from a friend, and because I'm supposed to be at the scene where I'm supposed to be having a nervous breakdown, they didn't end up shooting it. This is the tragic part. But the audition was Christopher goes in to see his mother and sees her in the coffin, and he hasn't had a chance to say goodbye, I love you, I hate you, fuck you, nothing. In all these years, they'd been estranged, and so he's this kind of erect dude who's going in to see his mom, and I go into the office, and I kind of had one way or another gotten gleaned just enough about what the part was and I worked on it somehow on my way over there to sort of look like the part, so that when I walked in, Stallmaster and Frank Perry looked at each other and then looked at me and said, good to see you. And I sort of had this like disheveled, the suit was a little too big for me. And I came in and I was sort of playing a little bit shell shocked, and I did the scene for them, and they just handed me the script and said, this is yours. And I think it was my 20, it was my, that was my 25th birthday, or 24th birthday, something like that. And I just remember floating across Paramount, holding the script, and sort of feeling like the years before E.T. was a movie, but they had that huge, background painting of a sky through, that covers the entire parking lot. The one end wall of the parking lot is this sky that they shoot against. Sometimes, I guess, when they don't have a blue sky and they need one, but it's just this sort of epic wall of blue sky. And it did, my feeling was, because I was parked over on the other side of the studio and I had to walk back across the studio to get to it, and just feeling like I was floating the whole entire way. And because the whole thing about Los Angeles is you gotta have a, before they'll give you a chance to be on film, you have to have film on you. And I had all these theater credits, and I'd had a million callbacks. I'd been through a full year of, yeah, I think it was definitely my 24th birthday, because I remember having come out at 23, having just turned 23, and basically just going through a year of rejection and not getting one thing, because they were afraid, like, well, he might turn into Zucchini in front of a camera. We don't know. He's a good auditioner. Well, what's going to happen when a camera turns on? I don't know. And so it was really a catch-22 about getting your first part. And this was a huge movie. It was purported to be like a big Academy Award kind of movie at the time, Paramount. But then Faye Dunaway was going through all kinds of things. The rumors were she'd been a junkie who was now sort of mellowing out on cocaine. And Frank Perry had lost his wife. And that had been his life partner and, you know, collaborator. And he'd been near a nervous breakdown because of having to deal with Faye just raking him over the coals and chewing up the scenery and driving everybody out of their minds, apparently. And I got to be good friends with Diana Scarwid, who played Christina. And she's one of the kindest, sweetest people on earth. And she basically left the business after that, just because, and she just had won, I think, Best Supporting Actress for something, Inside Moves or something like that, the year before. But she just, say, it was just a nightmare. And so by the time it got to shooting my scene, we did the lawyer's office scene first, and then came the scene where I'm supposed to go in literally 5 months after I got the part. The movie is over budget, over time. Everybody's out of their mind. I checked in at one point and come on set, and I'd met Faye briefly, like two movie stars in one, because she was all done up as Joan, getting out of a 1940s white Rolls Royce. Hello. And, you know, this is Andrew Burke, he's going to be playing Christopher, and blah, blah, blah. And it was all just so exciting. And then I spent the entire day in a funeral home waiting for my scene to go in there and have my nervous breakdown. And break down in front of the corpse in the coffin. And it was beautifully written. It was just so simple. It's just a few words that he says to himself and to her. But it was basically about the state of just losing it. And I'd held it together. And I just had lost my grandmother. So I had all this real emotion. We're in a real funeral home with real flowers. The putrefying smell of the 1,000 flowers in this room I was waiting in, to where they finally called me in the theater. You know, you go on 15, you know, you get to the theater an hour before, you put on your makeup, you go on stage, but not 7 hours. I'm just sustaining the state of waiting to have my nervous breakdown. And then Frank Perry comes over and goes, okay, so we're going to shoot the scene now. And, so Diane's going to come out from behind that curtain. The two are going to greet each other, and then you're going to walk out this way. And I'm going, when do I view the body? And he goes, oh, no, that's a scrub. No, we cut that month ago. You didn't know that? No. We don't know that I, Christopher, ever actually looked at the body. We don't know. No, what we're going to do is just, she's going to come out from behind the curtain. You can trigger each other, and then you're going to exit. And he prances off and says, remember, no acting. And I just went, a scrub? Oh, a scrub. What's a fucking scrub? And my father empathizing and saying, that's like being gang raped by the Hell's Angels and then run over by a Mack truck.
Welcome to showbiz, Cat. Yes, I want to be in pictures, do you?
Yeah, so that's a long story. I promise not to make any of the rest of them that long. But the good one.
Did that role end up doing anything for you, or was that just kind of a blip on the radar at that point?
Well, no, it anoints you on a certain level. I mean, I told you the long story because it sort of speaks to your first question of the why would anybody do this, choose this profession? And, you know, I'd always gotten steady work in the theater, but it did seem like an insane thing to choose to do. It's like and I remember even my father showed me, like, I encouraged you to do this, but I feel I should also caution you, look, here's the pie chart. This is how many people actually get into the Screen Actors Guild that are actors that are pursuing it. And now, here's the terrifying part. Among those in the Screen Actors Guild, here's the pie slice of those who actually make a living. And it's just such, the odds are so infinitesimal that you can, A, get in that slice and then, B, sustain it for any period of time, that it really does seem like an irrational choice to be making. But because I started so young, I thought I could afford to roll the dice. And, you know, I could always go back to school or whatever. I also always had the artwork, and I never stopped doing the artwork. And I was really good. I'd been hired from early on as a stage makeup artist. And because I had skills that, you know, from very early on. So I always knew I could get into special effects makeup or to twist it another way if I needed to earn a living. And especially being in Los Angeles, I felt that I could do that. So I wasn't scared that I couldn't get by. So, but it was a brutal welcoming into the business, and, the sense of anointment though that did come just from having, before the movie came out, just being Christopher Crawford in Mommy Dearest, because the book was such a big deal. And I was somewhat traumatized by the whole experience. And I thought, you know, I have so much experience on stage, but just being around cameras just felt like such a different beast that I thought very logically about. I just wanted to log hours in front of cameras. And I thought, I already knew at the time that, you know, I just did the math that there's X number of TV shows on the air and that they have a different bad guy every episode. And they must find him and bring him to justice by the end of the episode. And that was the formula that was out there. And that there was already a cultural Hollywood being ahead of the curve in terms of political correctness, I would say, had already wanted to avoid casting black guys and Latinos in the villain whenever possible. But the white guy with the because I had the skill of transformation, I could go in the office and make myself look scary, and I would do slight, very subtle makeup things. And I already had a slightly receding hairline, even very young. And, you know, the receding hairline is fine to cast for the bad guy. And I could make my eyes look really scary. And I could do certain other things. I had all sorts of tics and physical things that I could do. I could make myself look like a drug addict with makeup. And I could do all the mannerisms. I could make myself look like a psycho. And so I could manipulate my energy because of the stagecraft, and I could do all kinds of accents. I played a German terrorist right off the bat, and an English terrorist, not a terrorist, but an English sort of in a period. I did a lot of periods. So that was back before they had as many Brits in the business, and I got a lot of work that way. So I had the skills to get to land these jobs once I had a film like Mommy Dearest on the credit. I just started getting jobs in episodic television. And, you know, that allowed me to get more comfortable with cameras and then I thought I'd go back to the big screen because I just felt like big screen will show any flaws in your work will be very visible on the big screen in a way that just felt like disposable, sort of where you're going to get paid to get an education if you do episodic television. And then as soon as I got back into film, I tried to pretty much stay there and only do episodic television when I was like back in town from location and needed to refill the coffers because I did a lot of independent films. Didn't make much money.
Well, you worked with one of my favorite independent directors, which was Alex Cox, on quite a few of his movies. And I'm curious how you got involved with things like Sid and Nancy.
I would say that the makeup had a lot to do with that part. He was cast off of videotape. He was in London at the time, and I was cast out of L.A. It was a New Yorker character, so I'd put in time in New York and definitely had New York characters up my sleeve. And to play the junkie drug dealer, street lowlife character that was written in the script, I made myself up to, you know, break all the capillaries and darken the eyes and make it red inside and in the side of the mouth and put in egg whites in my hair and looked like I hadn't bathed in a long time. And then I had just this sort of patina, but like instead of putting powder to seal it, I had this stuff that was a little bit like soot powder to just pat on. All very, very, you could look at it up close and know I was wearing makeup, but I definitely like people would walk to the other side of the street instead of smiling and winking, let's say girls, as I walked down the street when I had that makeup on. The same girls that would, you know, smile and nod otherwise would actually cross the street to walk on the other side when they saw you coming. And so it definitely generated a different effect. And I then took it to the next level. You could smoke in offices back then, and I bought a pack of cigarettes and a bottle of beer and put it in a brown paper bag and let the cigarette smoke go into my eyes right before I went in, leaned over it, and so I looked completely fucked up when I walked in the door. And Vicky Thomas and I are born a day apart, a year and a day, but our birthdays are a day apart, and Alex's is another day apart. But that's neither here nor there. She was hysterical. We're still really good friends, and I was just reminding her this story, and she was, I did that. Oh, I'm sorry. She looked at the picture that she'd been given, my resume picture, and she looked at me, and she goes, you look really different from your resume picture. And I sat there smoking, sort of glazed. And I, yeah, well, you know, it's nice to be able to go to an audition. We don't have to get all spruced up and whatnot, you know. And she just sort of like shuddered a little bit and then, okay, shall we try this? And feel free to ad lib if you want to. We're going to do this scene. And I did ad lib. We had another scene that she'd set up with a kid that was going to read with me. And they put it on tape and it went well. And I got the part and it showed up on set in New York. And I showed up as myself, and Alex was, I was introduced to Alex, and his jaw dropped, and he went, oh, you're so clean. I thought somehow miraculously we had discovered a junkie who could act naturally in front of a camera. Oh, well, I don't suppose we could have avoided casting you since we'd immediately written some of your ad-libs into the script. So it goes, and he walked away so disheartened and disenchanted that I then went back to the hotel, got back in my gear, and never dropped out of character after that. It was just for him. I thought, okay, what the hell? It was such a great part. It was, that was his fantasy. I would, you know, like a call girl, I guess, having to play out the role play for the director. And the makeup artist had just won an Academy Award for Grace Stoke the year before. These two really lovely, charming, gay gentlemen from Great Britain, and they were standing behind me in the line at the hotel when they saw me fully made up, just thinking I was a homeless guy, and scuttling up to the front desk and asking them if they could keep the maid from going into my room for the next week. And then they were so taken aback when I walked into the makeup trailer. And I said, you can take this all off. I just want to let you know this is what got me the part. And I also want to let you know that the director was palpably disappointed when I walked in yesterday onto the set as myself. He was just so disappointed to meet me that I thought I better just at least show up on set the way he'd seen me on the videotape so that he wouldn't hate me. But I just thought I'd let you guys see it, and then if you want to take it off and put it on the way you saw fit. And the two of them looked at each other and they said, you're the bloke from the hotel, aren't you? And they started howling with laughter, and they said, well, you know, we did just win the Academy Award. So we may feel we have to do it ourselves, but bloody hell, good work, mate. And then they began my education in film makeup, which is, you know, it has different, because of the lighting and film resolution, there are different approaches that you can take, from stage. And, I always did it like, whenever I was going into a room, I always made my thing like, you cannot see that it's makeup. You must not be able to see that it's makeup, so it has to look dead real. But there's still, you know, loads of insider tricks and secrets, and I've gone on learning them. Billy Corso, William Corso, V. Neal, and other Academy Award winning makeup artists are really good friends of mine, and I continue to be in a really, really fortunate position of getting the state-of-the-art tips and techniques thrown my way, because they get a big kick out of the fact that there's an actor out there that does this stuff and loves it as much as I do. But yeah, that was the story of Sid and Nancy. And then he, you know, as soon as we were shooting the last scenes in Sid and Nancy, Alex leaned in and said, get your shots, we're going to Nicaragua. And I was like, isn't there a war going on there? And he's like, exactly. And like, oh dear, an anarchist, that's right, uh-oh. But I was on for the ride. And then there was a point at which, a couple of months in, I'd already turned down a couple of jobs. I got a call from Alex, meet me out in Santa Monica. And he explained, as you anticipated, perhaps, because there is a war going on in Nicaragua, I've been a bit of difficulty getting our visas in order. Therefore, I've written a spaghetti western in 3 days, which we will shoot in 4 weeks on the old Sergio Leone sets in Almeria, Spain. The actor, the musicians who provided the music for Sid and Nancy, the Pogues, Joe Strummer, Elvis Costello, and among others, are all very interested in trying to hand it acting. And they'll be looking to you for some acting advice. Are you game? And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Yes, I am. But, you know, it was a wild ride, the Alex Cox ride. He's one of the most brilliant, talented guys I've known, but I've never met a more self-destructive guy in some ways. His anarchy, his politics, just sometimes so extreme that it just got in the way of, I did feel like I watched a man shoot himself in one foot and then level his gaze at the other and then blow that one off too. But I would not exchange, for all the movies I turned down to stay available for his, I wouldn't exchange the experiences I had in Spain and Nicaragua for anyone else's movies or anyone else's career, because it was such a deep, rich experience, both cases. The people that I got to be lifelong friends with and the cultural, especially Nicaragua, because I then did a film back-to-back with another friend who hired me to do a film in Chile. So to go from the Sandinistas for 3 months to the Pinochet regime was... my mother had wanted me to be a diplomat or an ambassador or something dignified. And in the long run, I ended up choosing a lot of my films for the locations they shot on and the education I could get, sort of geopolitical And I always, you know, you'd meet the embassy when you're with the film, and you can then, you know, because I'm an artist and I draw everywhere I go. I go to the art supply store, which is near the university. And so I'd end up, you know, the cinephiles, the professors or whoever that recognized me from certain art films would bring me into the arts community of whatever city, whatever country I was in. And, then I could then introduce people from, you know, the deputy ambassador or junior diplomat could meet me down at the wood fire pizza place with the head of the student union, and knowing that they would have a very interesting connection over different subjects, and set things up that if I were in politics, if I were in the diplomatic services, it would have taken me 3 years of bureaucratic red tape to set up those meetings. And so I've had really an interesting and varied existence based on access that being with the film has provided.
I'm curious, you talked about how you would make yourself up to go into these roles. Do you still do that today? Is that still kind of your way of preparing your character?
I try not to audition too much anymore.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
A little over it, yeah. Yeah, I still want me to put myself on tape for this and that. And if it's some great film, I will in a heartbeat. And if it's something that would require me, I just haven't in a while, but if it's something that would require a transformation, I would surely do it. Yeah. I, in fact, there's a funny story. Jeannie McCarthy, who was in Sid and Nancy, became a casting director, starting working with Vicki Thomas, who cast Sid and Nancy, and became one of the top casting directors in the business herself, was casting the year one and, brought me in to meet Harold Ramis. And there was some pressure on him to hire some Brit or another to play the king of Sodom. They always want to go with a Brit to play a king. They say it's just the way they want to go so often. And, she wanted me to get a shot at it, and I knew I had to go for it. I had been given, one way or another, I had a Thracian beard from something that I had done. And so I got my spirit gum and my Thracian beard out and glued it to my face. And so it looked like it was completely my own. It was a really high-end lace hairpiece beard that had the Thracian sort of wave to it all the way down, and then blunt cut at the bottom, and it was hysterical. It looked very real if I was living in Thrace, but it was a very odd thing to be like running across the street in Santa Monica in. And I guess I didn't meet Harold. I went on videotape at Jeannie's office wearing that, and I think a long wig that I had, a long hairpiece. The commitment that I had to the part, and I don't think I wore any other makeup than that, but to do the part with this long hair and this Thracian beard, I think went a long way to his going, well, fuck, and the accent and everything else that I did for the film, just, it was, you know, this is more entertaining than Jeremy Irons. Let's go with this. We've seen, you know, he gets points for the glued on beard. I still do stuff like that. That's the part of me that's no different than the three or four. I have a photograph of myself at three or four or something like that, playing Robin Hood with the rubber stopper arrow. But my mother had made this beautiful Robin Hood hat and outfit, and I just look so fucking serious and intense pointing the arrow. Even with the rubber stopper, you feel like, whoa, don't shoot me, dude. And that's the power of a costume and makeup. And those are the two, to me, favorite parts still, as much as acting with another great actor and being transported, in the scene, finding the costume with the costume designer and finding the character in the makeup, and hair and makeup trailer are just just ridiculous joys for me to this day.
You talked about being in independent films, and you were in some of the best independent films in the late 80s, early 90s, especially one that I don't think could necessarily be made today, which was Todd Haynes' Safe. And that was such a great film and such a great performance in that.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, interestingly, you know, you obviously have a very similar taste to in directors that I do. Like, I do loved Alex's movies. I got a lot of Mike. I did four movies with Mike Figgis, as I did four with Alex. I got my first TV offer from a great television director named Colin Buxey on Miami Vice because of Sid and Nancy. And the British directors started hiring me after that because they just loved the character of the New York scumbag drug dealer. And that registered, and the film was so good. And Roger Deakins shot that film. And that was Gary Oldman's first film. And it was, there was something iconic about Sid and Nancy. And Todd loved that movie. And for some reason, he got in his head this idea when he was casting Safe that he wanted to meet me. And because he'd seen me in other things too and knew that I didn't look like the drug dealer in Sid and Nancy, but that he'd never seen me play straight, just like not straight versus gay, but just a straight guy, like just a normal dude. And so that was like his idea of interesting casting, was to just have me be just the straightest guy you could imagine from the Valley, who just doesn't have any idiosyncrasies or any, he's just so normal. And that he's not a bad guy at all. And that maybe because I played a lot of bad guys, that maybe it would be an effective mislead for the audience to keep thinking I'm going to leave her, or I'm going to, because I'd already played like the philandering husband in Candyman and other parts, like in Terminator 2, these kind of shady guys. So you're predisposed the minute you see my face at that point, even when I looked more or less like myself in both Terminator and in Candyman, that you're going to assume that I'm going to be up to no good. And so that was something he was willing to let the audience be led astray, to then have them turn out at the end going, well, he's not a bad guy. He just doesn't get it. He's not equipped. He doesn't know how to converse in this new age world of nuance. And that's his only real flaw. Otherwise, he's a really decent, sweet guy. And so to see me play against type and just be super. So the image and I loved the idea. We just talked about it. I don't think I auditioned. We just discussed the role and that would be really interesting. And I thought, you know, because you said just so straight, I thought, yeah, I think what I would want to do with it is like really not even allow myself to make any particularly sudden moves because my face is idiosyncratic and I have a tendency naturally to be animated. And so I would want to de-animate and de-eccentrify and normalize to the point where like I would make every move very deliberate and very right angular and or vertical or horizontal. And, you know, if I'm walk in a straight line and be so simple that there's, don't move unless I have to. Just be that spare and pared down. Because there was something that was so spare and pared down in the writing from the minute, I remember my agent sent it to me because there was a request for me to come in and audition for it. And this agent was just typical agent response, not of a great agent, but just a typical agent saying, they want you to come and read for this, or they want to meet with you. I think maybe on page 60 she gets a nosebleed. I forget. Nothing much happens. And I got the script and read it, and from the first description of, you know, her pulling the cereal box out and looking at the ingredients, I was like spellbound. It had such an atmosphere, the script. It was one of those scripts that was so spare, so enigmatic, that I remember thinking it's the first time I'd ever read a script where I won't change a word of this dialogue. I won't add a word. I won't take one away. And that's the only time I've ever read a script thinking that. Yeah, so I felt so honored to be a part of that storytelling process with Julianne and Todd, and the three of us did a lot of rehearsals. I had just bought my house at the time, and I had a nice backyard and a big house to do all the rehearsals, and they both lived in New York, and so that was our house to rehearse in, and that was awesome. It was a great experience.
I just wanted to let you know that it was probably inappropriate, but when you showed up and leaving Las Vegas, you had me rolling on the floor. You were a much needed moment of levity for me in that very oppressive film. So your cynical cabbie was fantastic.
Well, it's a fun side note. I met Mike. He'd just seen Sid and Nancy, and he brought me in. And he kind of had already cast Billy Baldwin in the part, and pretty much honestly told me so, and that I was probably too old. You know, he wanted to have more of an age difference between Gear and the new cop. But he wanted me to just prepare the scenes and come in, so that he could justify meeting me, because there wasn't another big part that was the part I was right for, and they hadn't closed the deal yet. And so I came in and auditioned for that part, and he just was excited to meet me because of seeing Sid and Nancy, and he had me improvise a lot, and he improvised opposite me with the camera pointing at me, and he's a, you know, just a super, another guy like Alex Cox, and I will also include Bernard Rose in this. These are the kind of guys that would have gotten 800s on both their SAT, you know, this, that kind of crazy brain. They're all English. I also sort of grew up on somewhat of an expat British community at one point on this farm that I grew up on. So I speak the language, as it were. I have the vernacular of the British, sort of encoded into me through my upbringing, and I understand them, they understand me, and a lot of the casting that British directors do is by just conversations, just like Todd Haynes was, in fact. And Wolfgang Petersen, I got the part of, in big part in Air Force One without auditioning, just by talking about the role. But a lot of British, I've worked with a ton of British directors, and it just came from just sort of speaking a language. And Mike and I just hit it off, and he really saw an ability in me to improvise. I'd started with that experimental theater company was an improvisational company that wasn't based on ha-ha improv, where you're always coming up with a joke in every other line, but situational, environmental, sort of character-driven improvisation is how I was trained early on. And so I could, in that movie, Internal Affairs, he kind of made a scene up for me to play a guy that's giving cops jobs on the side, but it's also connected to the internal affairs. So one way or another, it was just a scene that he wanted me to improvise in on the day with Gear, and basically to throw Gear off his moorings, to make him uncomfortable, because he had such a fix on the character, and he'd written the character for Gear. So I don't think he wrote that script, I can't remember, but the way the script was written had given Gear so much power that he just wanted to have a scene where there's somebody that was a little bit, who was kind of alpha-ing him, topping him, just wasn't easy. And so in the scene, the character's name was Rudy Moore, and I just kept, like, being a guy just deadpan, but kept, like, being a practical joker, just couldn't take anything seriously, and couldn't take him seriously. Thought that would be how I approach it, because Gere was playing very macho in this role, and so just in the scene, so I just kept making jokes up on the spot out of everything he said. Anybody gonna trust me? You gotta trust Rudy Moore. Got it? Rudy Moore? Ah, come on. You take yourself too seriously. And Gere goes over, and I remember him saying, do I break his legs now or later? And, I go, Richard, just enjoy the scene. Just do the scene. Stay in the scene, Richard. Just stay in the scene. And he actually got so uncomfortable, he did a couple of things that a very smart actor who doesn't want the scene to be in the movie does by repeating certain lines in the course of the scene. And so the part of it had to be cut out, but certain things remained intact. And when Billy Baldwin is in the scene, and he and I stayed friends forever from it, just because there was something, about, you know, I'm joking with him, something about, cause all you cops are in the powder and powder in your noses, get it, powder in your noses. And I did some cocaine reference, and, you know, it was all improvised, and look at this lurch over here, pointing to Billy Baldwin. Look at this kid's face. Are you kidding me? You know, and I was just saying shit, just talking shit the whole time, because I'm the one giving these guys jobs on the side, and they need me. And this, you know, Mike kept saying, hey, you need this guy. You need to keep the money coming in. This is guy, you know, you're being investigated. You need to, come on, fucking stay in the scene. And it was just like, and Billy was just like constantly on the verge of cracking up the whole time. And Mike just forever, I think, wanted me as his secret weapon. And that scene that you're referring to in Leaving Las Vegas was all improvised. And it was just, you get her in the car and just, you know, this is what's happened before, and this is where, you know, she goes to take it, and they had a camera mount on the thing, and so I could just drive and talk, and you know, so some of the best stuff comes out of the improvisation. In Sid and Nancy, the best stuff came out of the fact that Gary and Chloe had gained so much weight, not physically, but in the aesthetic weight of their characters. They'd gotten so into it, and they were blessed. We were all blessed that Alex had shot the film in chronological sequence almost entirely. So when it reached the point where we're at the Chelsea Hotel, Gary and Chloe just thought it was bullshit that they would have control over their drug dealer, and that everything was too clever and too snarky or something. And I had William Burroughs Junkie had been reading and just finished it. It was a beat up tattered copy in my back pocket. And I pulled out, I had this thing circled and said, well, in fact, there is evidence to be found from Burroughs himself saying that nobody ever has control over their heroin dealer. The heroin dealer always has the control, no matter how famous, no matter how, you know, certainly beyond the level of a Sid and Nancy level of fame. So I think there is a point to be made, but they said, oh, it's okay, so fuck it, so let's take the script, throw it out, we know what we need to keep. After we'd shot a scene that preceded this, and we were going to be shooting one of the big hotel room scenes that next day, we had the set, and he cleared the set except for Roger Deakins and Gary and Chloe and myself, and had us improvise based on what the script was. And he just made copious notes, and then next day provided us the shrinky pages. You know, you've been on sets, I'm sure. You know, the little reduced pages for what's going to be shot that day. Mm-hmm. And it was all the stuff we'd improvised, and that was put in his favorite parts of what needed to be retained from the original script in order to keep the story point on track. And that's. And right down to, like, I remember him saying, oh, problem, I've got to scrap one of your beautiful scenes because you cannot enter the hotel room because, as established in that fight, the door is locked. Therefore, now you may only open the door. We can cheat the chain a little longer, but you can only peer into the room, and now you see Gary holding knife, staring at television, trail of blood, Nancy on bathroom floor. What would you say? As I don't know, man. Bad scene. Something. I can't remember what it was. It was just like, bad scene. We like. There was a couple of other things like thrown in on top of that. But like, you know, some of the best stuff comes out of the situation and in the moment. And working with Mike Figgis, those two movies, and then One Night Stand, almost all of my stuff was improvised in One Night Stand. And then we had become pretty tight by the time we got around to doing Time Code, which I don't know if you ever saw. Have you seen it?
Yeah, Time I remember that one being a real tour de force of the actual, the style of the movie being really unusual.
Yeah, I still want to do a variation on that where it's one screen image instead of four, but the thing that was really remarkable is that 90-minute takes, it was all improvised. Mm. And, you know, it had four screen images and four camera operators that moved, and you moved, one had to move from one group to the next, from one camera to the next in different groups and, or solo, and led by a digital watch that one had to keep track of the time on. And so I'm about to enter a directorial phase of my career. My move to Maine is going to help facilitate that shift. The thing that I just found so stimulating about that is you rehearse for a week developing the script with actors who can improvise, and then you shoot for a week, and in this case, it's the very first, I think it was one of the first digital films. The luxury of a 90-minute take was that you say action, and then when you cut, it's done, you're done. And with four cameras, you can intercut. You don't have to stay locked to the four screen images. And there is something really dynamic about, like in a play where you have, you know, 90 minutes of action. It's all continuous and in chronological sequence and has the flow of adrenaline that real life does. If it's a 90 minutes of real time situation like that was. It was, and you've got actors, and as he did by that point, he'd found a group of actors that could all improvise. And it was a pretty fantastic experience. Yeah.
So you said there was a connection between Safe and Gattaca. I thought for sure there would have been a connection between Gattaca and another sci-fi epic that you did, which was Barbed Wire.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just kidding. I'm busting your balls a little bit, but I love Barbed Wire, to be frank. Even though it's kind of cheesy, I really enjoy that film.
Oh, it's terribly cheesy. I do too. What it is that there, I think you're just enough of a cinephile to maybe have seen some of the guy that wrote that was really smart and obviously very clever and basing it on Casablanca.
Yeah, that was great.
Pam Anderson in the Humphrey Bogart role was just enough to throw everybody off the scent of that. But, for the most part, there were a few of us that decided to make our references just obvious enough to make it known. But, they fired that director after 10 days because in that 10 days, when they first started shooting, I think right before they started shooting, I guess Pam showed up in the, all leather clad at the Cannes Film Festival as Barbed Wire with the Barbed Wire tattoo, and $10 million was added onto the budget. And suddenly it wasn't his movie anymore. It had been taken away.
Right.
And given to a very flashy rock video director who's great with visuals, but just had never really didn't know anything about it. We work with actors, and so it was certainly not the movie it could have been. It should have been a weird, dark little indie. Uh-huh. And so the script still had in it certain sort of futuristic elements that are just interesting enough that I thought you might have been able to thread a connection, but I was very surprised. I believe you humor much more.
Yes. So, please tell me about Gattaca and how you came to that one.
Well, it is through SAFE, and it was, I think, I'm not just being modest in saying it. I think it was, quite honestly, because, Andrew Niccol was such a fan of SAFE that he wanted to borrow, a palpable, element of the atmosphere, and bring it into Gattaca. He liked my acting. Obviously, I was the only actor that he cast. And perversely, I think the casting director, I won't name names, but I'll be honest and candid about it, has always held a grudge against me because he was a first-time director. He'd gotten to direct it because he had sold The Truman Story with the caveat that he would get to direct Gattaca. And that a first-time director is going to be given one of the most powerful casting directors to sort of guide him through the process with the studio as, you know, just, it was sort of a given. And this very powerful casting director didn't, I remember him telling me just how not kindly she took to his announcing to her that that role was cast from the start. And it was the only role. He said, no, we'll be looking for, but Dr. Lamar is cast. Which is, what do you mean? I have several great choices for the role. It's cast. Why? And I would say that it was, you know, not just by any means his wanting me as an actor, but because the meticulousness of his aesthetic and right. his research and, like, is it just 300 to 600 pages, I can't remember, of images, and I remember the table read, who we had, you know, fantastic people that weren't in the movie, but there was just this table read assembled so he could hear the script read, and I was the only one that was cast already. So I'm the only person that heard all these other great actors read these parts. But he showed us at that table read this book that he'd already assembled with photographs and drawings and articles and, you know, just mostly photographs with all the science and, you know, slides and just all kinds of things in this presentation that was just mind blowing. And, I just remember feeling like I was looking into the future when I leafed through the pages. And there was something I think that Todd created in the atmosphere of SAFE that had a really, there was something futuristic and sci-fi and just disarming. And the fact that the day that we were supposed to start shooting SAFE was the day of that, the big earthquake in LA. And so our first day of shooting was postponed by 4 days. And the whole time we were shooting, we were experiencing aftershocks. And there were big aftershocks. And the whole time we were out at that retreat, we would have to just go flying out of that building, which didn't seem particularly secure, and go outside. And right outside where we would all run to get out of the building was this cluster of, I think it was an oak tree that had 4 massive trunks, sort of all sort of like a bouquet. You know, those trees sometimes that just grow together, and it's 4 big trees together as one, because it's 4, so it just, I forget what kind of tree it was. Maybe it's a particular kind of tree that does that, but it happened to be out there, north of, somewhere like Malibu Ranch or somewhere out there where we were shooting, and we would just watch this massive tree shake and shudder and shimmy in the aftershocks. And it was, you know, we were just, it was, and it was right through there that we got to see that incredible, indelible image of the guy that, you know, I think it's on the poster for SAFE, the guy that's kind of got the oxygen mask on and the tank on his back, and he's scuttling around, and it looks like an alien. And it's just somebody who has environmental illness that needs to go around with the tank on his back, but he was almost wearing like a spacesuit kind of look as he went through that landscape. And there was a feeling that the environment was out to get us, created by the atmosphere of that script, that was enhanced deeply by the aftershocks and put into our adrenaline because we were all on adrenaline. We just, when you're in a building and you have an aftershock, adrenaline is released into your system. You can taste it. And, it was just a really, I think, interesting part of that process and affected how we all felt during it. And I just, on some level, I think that Andrew picked up on just what was just so unusual and special and strangely disturbing and sci-fi and futuristic about SAFE, and wanted a chunk of it in his movie along with whatever other references he was making and incorporating. And I was that element for him, as well as a good actor to play the part of the doctor. And which is really smart, really interesting, and he stuck to his guns, and that casting director never brought me in for anything after that. It's funny. Like, she took it out, she, you know, somehow held it against me.
The people who ended up on screen, it's such a great mix, and just, you know, Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman, and then to have Gore Vidal to show up as in an acting role was phenomenal. I mean, such a great mix of people. Even
Alan Arkin, Ethan and I hit it off, and we were sitting there at the lunch table together most days that I was there, and there were 2 days back to back. And one day where Gore Vidal held court, and one where Alan Arkin held court. And both of them richly entertaining, and both experiences that neither of us would ever have traded in, but we both had the same exact experience, just on an emotional level that... And it sort of reminded me of something that my father had said about Gore Vidal. Yes, Gore Vidal's been having a massive love affair for many, many years with himself. And and we watched it, because I remember Ethan had the exact same reaction, because he's so brilliant. But he was holding court, and after he got up to leave, Ethan turned to me and said, "What a fucking gas bag." And... And I said, "I know, but so brilliant, right? I mean, how great that we got to go." "I know, oh, I know, but what a fucking gas pack." And then Alan Arkin was sitting there the next day, and he and I, just like when he got up to leave, we both looked at each other, "Oh my fucking God." So fucking lucky. He told the best stories and the best jokes, like old theater jokes, that either of us have ever heard, ever. And so it's just an interesting sort of contrast of these guys that just carry the stories. But it's just how one comes off compared to the other. And, you know, I love reading Gore Vidal. I always enjoyed him as an author and as a journalist in a way, and a commentator of society and all the rest of it. But that is just, which isn't to say that we aren't all big fans of his as a writer.
Right, right. Yeah, the writer and the man can be different people, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. But Alan Arkin, huge points on both fronts as an artist and as a person. So impressive. But Ernest Borgnine was there. I mean, we got to hang out with Ernie Borgnine. Yeah, I mean, he cast that. And I will say, to that casting director's credit, the people that she brought on board. Now, Gore, I must also tell you, Ethan and I had to deal with his having huge cue cards. It's just like, what? And he was like, it's like he thought he was Marlon Brando or something. I think he thought that was better than learning his lines. And you could just see his eyes going from side to side as he read his lines, and it sounded like he was reading his lines. And we thought, like, well, come on, man, just learn your fucking lines. Look at us. We're the ones talking to you, not that big cue card over there. But, you know, it was Gore Vidal, and it was a brilliant use of him in that. And just as it was Ernest Borgnine and Alan Arkin, and all the choices were great. And Uma and Ethan, that was a good call on chemistry. I was there at the table the day they met. I was there at the lunch table the day they met, yeah. There were some sparks of flying. Yeah. Hey, I was there when Tom and Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson met. Yeah. I was there for their first encounter. Their one that stood the test of time. The famous Hollywood wedding marriages and you sometimes come in contact with. It ain't easy in this crazy business. I took my hat off to them. But so that's a connection of Safe to Gattaca. And then if you want to ask anything else about Gattaca.
Well, I did want to ask how that urine tasted.
That's right. I'd completely forgotten. Is that
on the DVD, outtakes, right? In the outtakes, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That was because it wasn't actually urine, but I think I did think that would be a funny thing to do for an outtakes if they did. Nobody knew. I don't think anybody knew I was going to do that. I don't think I've ever had anybody reference that before, so I'd completely forgotten about that. I think it was just good old lemonade or yellow food coloring or something. I'd watched it being made, though, so I knew I was safe. Although I've heard that, you know, both monks and people climbing in the high mountain peaks have had to survive on their own urine at different times. And if you're dying of thirst, I guess it's a quencher.
I did say, kind of in jest at the beginning, that I haven't seen all 231 roles that you've done over the years, but of some of those, what have been your favorites to do?
Well, you cited a lot of them, and I really enjoyed this interview because of the ones that you, from the very beginning, referenced. You know, even you're mentioning Fire in the Mountain, which is, I didn't even know if that was on my IMDb list, but I sure got a kick out of working with, you know, as a kid coming into the business, like I said, I was just a kid pretty much, and to be working with Buddy Ebsen and Ron Howard, Opie, and Jed Clampett and Opie at the same time, come on. You just pinch yourself. It's a film that I've worked with my favorite Martian on The Incredible Hulk, XP. Well, he wasn't my favorite Martian. I wish I'd gotten to work with that guy. He was great. You know, on MASH, to Harry Morgan, and Alan Alda, all those guys. Those things you referenced even in passing seem like inconsequential sort of credits, but they were incredible experiences for me as a kid starting out. Because you're wide-eyed and stuff. And even, you know, though I wasn't like a Clint Eastwood fan, particularly by any means of his politics, when I was growing up and even of his acting, when you get hired to work for him, you can't help but to be impressed and to be able to incorporate stories of his where you get to do an impersonation of him doing him talking to you. That's as much fun as it is the ones that were your heroes, like Al Pacino, and getting to work with him both on stage and on film. So there's like kid in a candy shop kind of experiences left and right. I would say Apollo 13 because I was so infatuated with space and the original. I was a little boy when the first programs were started. I was up for, had a bunch of callbacks. And I think it was between me ultimately, even though I was a little too young and he may have been a little older. I was a little younger than Alan Shepard was at the time, for The Right Stuff. It was when I first came to Los Angeles. I got a lot of callbacks for that. It was very close. So getting in Apollo 13 was like a dream come true just to be a part of that. And because they shot a whole lot that didn't get included, and I was fine with that because it was a testament to how brilliant the film was, that it didn't need to be included. But I was, as Ron referred to me, his insurance policy, because I was head of the press corps, and we did have a kind of space school for 2 weeks before we started filming. They'd recreated the set at Universal's back lot of NASA as it had been in the 60s. And these guys that had been in charge of, you know, ground control of Houston and NASA in the 60s, as well as Jim Lovell and others that had walked on the moon, were there as technical advisors teaching us about, you know, basically teaching us space school for 2 weeks before we started filming. And that was such a deep, rich, extraordinary experience. And I had a particular sort of area of study that I was being given because I had to extrapolate techno terminology into layman terminology so that they could have a whole series of scenes throughout the film that they could cut to at any given moment if they needed to, of the press corps shooting questions at me, technical questions at me about what's going on, as an assist to the audience to follow what was happening. And so I could then improvise and extrapolate into layman's terminology these different technical things. And it was a very exciting thing to get to film, and very cinema verite, and it was a big movie to get to do that kind of improvising in. It was fantastic, and Ron loved it, and the camera, we had all had a great time. And at the end of the day, when he said, you know, it's just, the fact is that there was just such an adrenaline, you know, sort of momentum to the film that they didn't need to have everything explained because they were just on board for the ride. And he said, but I can't tell you how much you facilitated putting my mind at ease throughout the entire process, knowing that I had any one of these scenes to cut to at any time that I needed to. And I think we always maintained a really good connection, even though for whatever reason he hasn't found. I know he always, every time I run into him, he's always saying, God, what did I see you in the other night? You were so good. He's just always been really a kind supporter. He was the executive on 24, and I didn't have to audition for that because I know he, among others, gave a thumbs up. And yeah, he's just a fantastic human being. And working with Rob Reiner, you know, again, here's somebody you grew up watching and all, and then I went in to read Jane Jenkins and Janet Hershenson, two casting directors whose names I like to mention because they cast me in Apollo 13, they cast me in A Few Good Men, they cast me in Air Force One, and some of the biggest movies I ever got to do. And I almost did a whole bunch of other incredible movies thanks to them. But they did put me in just a string of great films. And they brought me in for one part. It seemed like I was a little too young for the one that I got, and so Jane hadn't brought me in. But the part that he had, that they brought me in for, I was in the middle of reading, and Rob said, wait, stop. He's way too good for this part. You're so good. You're so natural. Just hang on. What else do we have? What about Captain Whittaker? Not too young. No. Go on the Hawk. Go take, I'm sorry. Yeah, it'd be like a call remit. I understand. And just go take a look at Captain Whittaker. And I did. Yeah. This is perfect. He's perfect for this. Yeah. Guys, great. Yeah. So I got I did a little research going down to the Navy base and interviewing. It was sort of an amalgam of two different parts, both the professor of law and a captain. And I got to interview both down at the Naval base in San Diego, I guess it was, I forget. But, you know, I've just, North Country was a bell ringer of an experience just because of the level of that cast. I don't know if you ever got to see that, but if you haven't, I recommend you do, just because it's just one out of the park performance after the next. And an underrated film, about the first class action lawsuit, about sexual harassment amongst women in a very male-dominated environment like the mining industry was at that time in Minnesota. And just, we all bonded, as sometimes happens, a certain level of, just like in Sid and Nancy, and there's one that you may not have seen, the Cherry Orchard. In it was shot in Bulgaria at the ex-king of Bulgaria's estate. I was the only American in it. Charlotte Rampling and Alan Bates played the brother and sister, and a wonderful actress, Melanie Lynskey, and it was Gerard Butler's second film, but Andrew Howard, and a lot of just the Welsh and two Welsh actors, a Scottish actor, Melanie from New Zealand, and Tushka Bergen from Australia. And just, you know, it was an art film that Michaelis Kokkianis, who directed Sorba the Greek and Iphigenia and Aulis and Electra and all these other great, great films, had spent the last 6 years writing a film script of, and then spent a year going around the world to cast it, and had this idea in his mind, and we all fell in love. Just like, it was just something about that group of people that he found that he wanted to tell that story, and the faces and the voices. Catherine Cartledge passed away the year after. It was just, she's that wonderful ectomorph in Naked, along with David Thewlis. She's a dark-haired girl in that, just way before her time. She had a rare blood disease, and we lost her and broke all of our hearts. She's just an incredible person and actress. And he said it up, so we all had to be there from the first day to the last day, because he was a theater director, and he just wanted that experience. And he had everyone's last scene be their exit from the cherry orchard the day they leave. And there was a rain machine. It was at night, and we all just exited out into the rain, out of the cherry orchard, sort of making our last look around before we left. And one by one, we sat outside in this marble courtyard. It was extraordinary, with the cherry blossoms. The biggest cherry orchard anywhere in the world was there at that ex-king's estate in Bulgaria. And the blossoms were, you know, just in full bloom, and the scent of them in the air. And we all knew that this was over, this experience, and that we'd all come together, and that, and we all were both, and I think everybody was a theater actor as well as a film actor, and we just had this feeling that we were this gypsy tribe that come from 100 broken families, where we meet and fall in love and come together as a family, and then the family disperses and moves on, and you stay in touch with certain ones here and there, and you see them again, some you never see again, they die. And as Alan did not too long after, and Michael Goff, and others, you know, you never know. It was an incredible moment telling that story together. And you know, there's been a few of those that I just feel so extraordinarily fortunate to have been a part of. And that's what I want as a director. I want to bring those kind of magical people together with a magical story and great writing and great people and great, you know, cinematographer, and bring a crew and tell a beautiful story and have everybody, because I really am convinced that when you've got that kind of magic, the storytelling is enhanced.
Well, there is so much more I want to ask you, but I'm hoping maybe we can talk again one of these days when you have finished up your first directing effort.
Let's save it for then. Yeah, because I've certainly yammered on to give you plenty to have to edit through in order to get something you can use now. So, but reach out anytime.
All right, will do. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it too. I could tell, you know, sometimes you just sort of get a blank on things at this point, and I could tell this is going to be a fun one. That's why I had to wait until I really had the time I could take to commit to it. And thank you for hanging in there with me.
All right, we are back, and we're talking about Gattaca. So, Chris, you were saying before as far as the idea of geneticists actually still talking about this movie. It's interesting that the DVD copy, which, incidentally, Skiz, I bought in Baltimore when you and I were yard sailing one time. So it was a good purchase.
I remember.
Yes.
Because if you hadn't bought it, I was going to buy it. And by coincidence, a year later, I bought mine at a yard sale in the same neighborhood.
Very nice. I found that I actually had two copies of Gattaca, the one that I bought with you and then one that I must have bought on my own. And the one that I bought on my own is the genetically inferior copy. It's not even widescreen. There's no extras, nothing. Yeah.
Oh, no.
The selling point that they tout is that they have chapter stops. So.
Oh, hey. Those are big.
Also, to add to the irony, I'm going tomorrow to donate platelets at the Red Cross. And last time I was there, I watched a movie. They have a movie selection because it takes about 2 hours when you donate your platelets. So I am bringing them my old copy of Gattaca, the 1 to 1.33 version, and they can keep that in their video library for other people to enjoy.
There's kind of that's almost poetic in a way. I like that. That will make some science nerd chuckle when they see that.
I read also a really interesting look at this movie in terms of it being a passing movie. And if folks don't know what a passing movie is, they're a thing of the past, but they still happen. There was a movie with Anthony Hopkins where it was a passing film, and I think it was based on a Philip Roth book. That's, I believe, a passing story. And, of course, things like Imitation of Life or Pinky or some of these other movies, especially more in the 50s and 60s, were about usually women of color who were passing for white women. Occasionally they would have men of color passing for white guys. And then you go, you know, the other way and you have like Soul Man, and you've got that – oh, God, what was that – the one with the British comedian who was a black guy and was playing a white dude. I remember the poster for that.
True Identity.
And then you even get things like Whoopi Goldberg passing for an old white dude. So they were kind of lampooning passing films with those, but the other passing films were usually much more dramatic, and it was this whole idea of, you know, oh my gosh, I didn't realize, some of it was, I didn't realize that I had, you know, black blood in me. I was a mulatto, blah, blah, blah. So it's, but there was some movies where there was purposeful passing going on, and there was always that fear of being caught. And with this, it's like taking that idea and updating it so many years into the not too distant future, next Sunday AD, and having Jerome passing as this, you know, genetically superior, quote unquote, person, even though he's got a heart bigger than everybody else, not necessarily literally, but his dreams are bigger than his body can handle. And he ends up, you know, doing all of this stuff so that he can get out into space and get to hopefully a better place where they don't worry about this kind of horse shit. But it was an interesting take to see, you know, how passing movies of old kind of speak to Gattaca.
It's interesting that you're able to put Gattaca in a genre with Tootsie and Mrs. Doubtfire.
And of course, that there's that famous Saturday Night Live sketch where Eddie Murphy passes as white, yeah, which is probably the most famous and contemporary example of what you're going for here.
Let me get this straight, Mr. White. You'd like to borrow $50,000 from our bank, but you have no collateral. You have no credit. You don't even have any ID. Is that correct?
That's right.
Mr. White, I'm sorry. This is not a charity. This is a business.
Harry, why don't you take your break now? I'll take care of Mr. White.
Oh. Okay. Thanks, Bob.
That was a close but one.
It certainly was.
We don't have to bother with these formalities, do we, Mr. White? Huh?
What a silly Negro.
Just take what you want, Mr. White. Pay us back any time. Or don't. We don't care.
Wow, that sketch is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good.
What I think is really interesting about this movie is this, this is a movie that, you know, it's kind of found its audience somewhat over the past 21 years, but I'm still surprised at how much it's left out of, like, the conversation when it comes to, like, contemporary, you know, cult classics, for lack of a better term, because there's so much in here that I think, like, could really, you know, audiences now could really pick up on and appreciate, but it's still kind of very under the radar, which I found surprising. I thought after the success of The Truman Show, a lot of people would go back and kind of rediscover this, but with The Truman Show being this, you know, having this skin of being a very, you know, I remember The Truman Show, they were almost trying to market it as this really sophisticated art house film, and it really is just a dumb film that I didn't care for at all, that tries to be it tries to pass for an art house film, actually, so it's a passing film in its own way. But I thought after The Truman Show came out, it was such a big deal that people would rediscover this movie a little bit, and it just hasn't happened. And, you know, I guess I'm at peace with that, because not every under the radar film has to be appreciated on a wide level. I just feel this is one movie that I'm constantly over the years spreading the gospel for, because it is so inventive and original and has a lot to say that is going to have future repercussions in society, I think.
You know, every time I mention this film to people or it comes up in conversation, usually whoever I'm talking to rolls their eyes and mentions either Ethan Hawke or Jude Law, as if that the film is somehow discredited because they're in the film. And, you know, I don't really follow actors. I didn't really even know who either of them were when I first saw this film. I mean, I'm sure I saw the films they were in, but I wasn't paying attention to them as actors, and I didn't really care. And I don't necessarily even like Ethan Hawke's acting in this film, but that does not take away from the fact that I love the film, you know, just in general. And I often wonder, like, does everybody remember this film just because of who's in it, or did they actually watch it? We know they didn't watch it because it wasn't a huge success, but at this point, I mean, enough years have passed that it's like, just put that casting aside and check it out and enjoy it for what it is.
It's time for us to forgive Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, I feel like the before movies, like you said, like after this, I went and I watched a bunch of the other stuff, and yeah, I mean, I have forgiven Ethan Hawke, and I think you're right. I think it's time. I think it's time.
I mean, he has been in some of my favorites now. You know, in I will say, like, say what you will, I don't really care your opinion about this, but I fucking love Daybreakers. I really love that movie. So, yeah, suck it. You know, that one and the other movie that he did with the Spirit Brothers, why am I forgetting the name of it? Predestination. Also a fantastic film. So he's done a lot of great movies over the years. Not all of them get to me, you know, like I still haven't watched The Purge. I still haven't, and this is one of them that will come back to haunt me. I still haven't seen Training Day, but you know, there's a lot of other stuff that I've seen of his that I really enjoy.
Yeah, we're a long way out from Reality Bites here, which was the movie that, you know, it kind of, I mean, look, I was of the age that was supposed to be like, this is the movie that's speaking to me about my generation, and not so much.
And I will recommend, if people haven't seen In Time, check that out. That's another nice movie as far as a contained sci-fi story. And it also deals a lot with the haves and the have-nots when it comes to that storyline as well. That one's a little heavy-handed at times, but I enjoyed it. I would recommend that. I haven't seen The Host, which was the next movie that he did after that. Apparently, he's working on a script for a movie called Monopoly, which I can only hope is an adaptation of the board game, because I think we're long overdue for that. So, Andrew Niccol, if you're listening, whatever you're doing in that script, I hope that it has Mr. Moneybags in there, because again, talk about a movie that has the haves and the have-nots. That would definitely be there. You'd be hanging out on Park Place in one scene. It looked very much like when Jerome and Irene leave the club and you have that green in the background. Everything could be color-coded to what the tiles on the board were. It would be fantastic. The other thing we're talking about, too, as far as like the whole idea of the, and I won't call it steampunk because it's not steampunk. You know, it's more what I was saying before, the fedora's future kind of thing. I mean, Roger Ebert was falling the fuck all over himself about Dark City, which came out the following year, came out in 1998. And Dark City, it's an okay movie, but the idea of this kind of timelessness and, you know, using older things to represent newer things and all that. I mean, yes, that's been done before. We talked all the way back to like in the 60s, and I'm sure even before that. I mean, even going back, you know, Chris, you're talking about 12 Monkeys, even Le Jetty, there's a lot of stuff that is, you know, just like, yeah, we'll put some weird glasses on this guy and now it looks like it's the future. Dark City, they were doing a lot of the same things style-wise that they were doing in Gattaca, and I think that Gattaca is a more solid film. I will go back to Gattaca easily, whereas Dark City is not necessarily a movie that I revisit more than once. So, yeah. Whereas Gattaca, I've seen probably at least 6 or 7 times over the years.
Yeah, the style of this kind of reminds me a little bit of Brazil, which I remember Terry Gilliam always saying that he wanted the film to look like it could take place at any point during a century, you know, whether it was the past or the future, just any, all points within a century could be happening at the same time. And that's kind of how this, how Gattaca is, with the old cars, but the new technology in them. It's a very similar idea.
I'm going to pretend for a second like I give a shit about the Academy Awards and just mention that it was nominated for Best Art Direction. It lost, but it was nominated, but at least it got some sort of critical attention in that respect, because this is just a beautiful film to watch.
It would have lost for Best Popular Art Direction. This is normally where we take a break and I play a preview for next week's show, but there really aren't a lot of trailers for the films that we're going to be covering over the next month, because we are returning to Czechtember, where we look at a handful of Czechoslovakian films over the period of September. We're going to be kicking that off with a discussion of And the Fifth Horseman is Fear, where I will be joined by Ben Buckingham and Kat Ellinger. Till then, I want to thank this week's co-hosts, Skiz and Chris. Boy, there's a lot of S's in that sentence. Who you'll be hearing again from soon via our episode, The Public Image is Rotten. So, Skiz, what has been happening in Baltimore lately?
Oh, what hasn't been happening in Baltimore? Been working on some films, or actually been working on promoting some films that I stopped working on, and just making a lot of music in this town.
I hear that that movie that you worked on for like 19 years, that's actually done now.
Yes, Ice Pick to the Moon, the documentary on Reverend Fred Lane and Rodellinus, is now on the festival circuit, as is Sickie's Making Films, Joe Trapea's documentary on film censorship that I co-produced and DP'd. Both are playing at festivals, hopefully near you now.
And where can people go to find out more about those films, Skiz?
The Fred Lane film, you can go to fredlanedoc.com, and Sickie's, you can go to sickiesmakingfilms.com.
How about you, Chris? How is everything in the city of brotherly love?
Great. No, things are fine here. I'm just gearing up for it's convention season. I do a lot of work with like New York Comic Con and things like that. So I'm just getting ready for all that. And yeah.
And how about you? Is there a good place where people can keep up with your stuff?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Bionic Bigfoot and at Sci-Fi Explosion.
You guys are the worst self-promoters in the world. You should both take a page out of the Chris Gore or Lloyd Kaufman playbook.
Oh, my God.
I should have heard like 12 Twitter references in there, an Instagram account, and neither one of you mentioned Instagram. You're falling behind. You're slacking. Both of you are slackers.
Social media is poison.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you guys for being on the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Now, check this out. Please head on over to the website, projection-booth.com, where you can find out more about today's episode. You also find links over to iTunes, where you can rate and review the show, and to Patreon, where you can make a donation to the show. Donors get early access to every episode, as long as I'm not running late. Every donation, every rating, every follower on Twitter, because we do the tweets, we do the Instagrams, all that kind of stuff. Everything helps the Projection Booth take over the world.
Good job.
That's how you do it. I have learned. I've learned something today.
never know why when you see her. Quite aware, mistaken identity. OG machine. I'm the really pregnant
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
Hey, sports fans. Football season's here, and it's time to get in on the action. MyBookie.net is the industry-leading sports action website that offers real Vegas odds on football, baseball, and all your favorite sporting events. You can take a side, the total, or even player props. MyBookie.net lets you play online and win big. Did the game already kick off? Don't sweat it. MyBookie.net has in-game live action on all major sporting events. There's no better time to join MyBookie than today. Go to MyBookie.net to open an account and start winning. Use promo code LEGEND when signing up to be entered into their $1 million prize pool. Get in on the action. Visit MyBookie.net today. Call 844-722-2387. That's 844-722-2387. Or visit mybookie.net and sign up today. Terms and conditions apply. For entertainment purposes only. Void where prohibited.